AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
It's The Wonky Show. We're talking R&D and the Defence Review, admissions, the policing bill, and a new report about HE&FE competition. It's all coming up.
Banging a drum outside of an office, that is a classic bit of, you know, it's a classic bit of protest tactic. I have the joy of working in Millbank Tower when I'm not working from home, and you know, it's a daily occurrence. This, I think, has sort of been born from the Extinction Rebellion actions of the past couple of years. Certainly when I worked at King's trying to get across Waterloo Bridge when they were occupying the bridge was a real experience. So,
welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's editor-in-chief, Mark Leach, recording from home as usual. And joining me on the launch pad to count down this week's HE policy highs and lows, I have three brilliant guests. On campus, we have Osama Khan, Vice Provost Education at the University of Surrey. Osama, welcome, and your highlight of the week, please.
Hi, Mark. We got a cat in the family, so we are really excited about it. Lockdown made it very difficult for all of us. Having a new family member running around the house was brilliant.
And in London, it's Anne-Marie Canning, CEO of the Brilliant Club. Anne-Marie, your highlight of the week?
Yeah, a student that I worked with many moons ago when they were in sixth form is now a PhD tutor with the Brilliant Club, which is a moment of sort of full circle for me. So yeah, wonderful, wonderful moment this week.
Ah, lovely. And from Team Wonky's Southwest Massive, it's David Kernahan, Wonky's associate editor, also known as DK. DK, your highlight of the week?
Well, it's another getting through lockdown one, I'm afraid, in common with many others in the country. I get a regular order from my favourite brewery, and it comes today, so I'm quite excited about that.
Exciting. I've got one coming tomorrow. I just got a text notification saying it's on its way. We start the week with the government's big defence review and the news that the research budget is to face further cuts. Osama, will you talk us through this one, please?
Sure. So there has been a very interesting integrated review report from the government, which talks about security, defense, development, foreign policies, and puts science and technology right at the middle of the international relations. There are big kind of aspiration. The Prime Minister is saying that United Kingdom has to position itself as science and tech superpower by 2030. I must say that's really exciting for a research community like ours and across the country. But on the other hand, interestingly, Julia Buckingham, Professor Buckingham, the chair of the UUK, also recently wrote to the government expressing concern about Treasury budget cut, which probably has the potential of us not continuing with our Horizon UK or Horizon EU projects, nearly £1 billion potential shortfall, which amounts to about 18,000 academics, researchers not being in place. So there are a bit of a kind of contradiction, I would say, here, where in one hand, the Prime Minister is saying, you know, science and tech superpower, Britain just ramp up its research and work collaboratively across the globe. But on the other hand, there are these uncertainty about what do we do with our existing research. I think there is also a little dimension in the integrated report about international relations and China becoming a potential superpower, asserting its geopolitics power, and also becoming the largest investor into research and development. So how do we work with China? How do we collaborate? We have a strong relationship with them. And how do we reconcile sometimes a bit of discrepancy in our values?
Thank you. And I think the one of the things sort of falling out of this review has been the kind of the politics about the relationship between China and the UK rearing its head again, particularly in the Conservative Party. And it's something we've been tracking quite a bit on Wonky, because obviously the amount of relationships and business that the sector does with China is quite vast, really, and little changes of policy and attitude can make big impacts. So I was interested in how Boris Johnson appeared to kind of warm up the relationship again after some significant cooling. And I know that Surrey, your university, does quite a lot of work with China. I know it has a big partnership with Huawei and has been on the slightly tricky end of some of these tensions over the last couple of years. I mean, what signals do you get as a kind of major university in the UK with I would describe kind of significant activity in China and with China? What are the signals you're getting as part of all this that are coming from the government? Is it heading back towards slightly warmer relationship, or is it cooling down again?
Absolutely. I do read the integrated review more like heading towards the warmer relationship, which is, I think, to be honest, as a international university and where we produce researchers and citizens for the whole globe, that is a massive welcome, to be honest, from Surrey's perspective. And I would say that across the university sector as well. Yes, we do have a good relationship in terms of doing research with Chinese partners. In fact, most of the British research-intensive universities are extremely diverse community. So, for example, myself come from Bangladesh. My vice-chancellor comes from China. We are a multifaceted international community pushing the boundaries of knowledge by doing exciting research that solves global problem. And there is a lot of indication in the report about solving global problems by partnering with the superpowers. And I think that is really exciting. And that's a positive step towards the right direction.
TK, you listened in to Dominic Cummings' appearance at the Science Technology Committee this week. And he had quite a lot to say about all this. And in particular, ARIA, which is why he was there. What jumped out at you from all that?
Well, I mean, Dominic Cummings is a political sketch writer's dream, really, isn't he? The seriousness in which he takes what are quite technical points about the funding of innovation and support for scientific development, it's almost kind of verging on self-parody. The big eye-opener for me, when Dominic Cummings took his job in Number 10, he set some conditions, things that he wanted the government to do in order for him to feel that he was worthy of working in Number 10. Which, you know, feels a little more like a foreign policy negotiation than like actually somebody becoming a SPAD, which is what we're talking about. So he asked for four things. He wanted the science budget to be doubled. So he's saying like, okay, if I work for you, Boris, I want you to spend an extra £11 billion of public funds in a way I say. Which, you know, is a perfectly normal thing that happens in all kinds of sensible countries. We then have a massive reform of the civil service to allow for a new approach to science funding, which is something ARPA-like, which we've eventually got to in ARIA, although he's not quite happy with that, as I'll get to. And the other one was committing to actually leave the European Union. So there he is, a SPAD in his interview negotiation is setting foreign policy, is setting science policy, is setting treasury policy. It's utterly unheard of. I've never seen anything like it in my life. So,
if he's to be believed, if we're taking him at his word.
I think we have to at this point in that he doesn't really have any reason to lie about this stuff at this stage. But so, I mean, that for me was the big, big story from the thing, from the appearance at the Science and Technology Committee. But the other thing I saw was just how deep these ideas about innovation and science and technology funding models actually go. He is obsessed. This is his big thing. Forget about Brexit. Forget about owning the libs and cultural wars. This is the reason he went in to do all of the things that he did in his political life. He sees ARIA as providing a space where innovation will happen. He talks a lot about 60s ARPA, which kind of managed to invent a couple of the technologies underpinning the internet, in the gaps between massively escalating the war in Vietnam. So it is nice that they can name check. He still wants to see a wholesale change in the way all science and technology. He had a strange habit of referring to Ottilien Laser by her first name as if they were best mates, which I would be suspicious of. So he's obsessed with this stuff. It's like an educational technology keynote from 2006. We're talking about ARPA, we're talking about Linklater, we're talking about different models of innovation and where they're important. And it's just incredible that this man and this set of views, which in the mid-noughties would have been like absolutely commonplace. Everybody was talking about this, everybody was blogging about this, have become the principal influence on government policy in 2021. It is utterly bizarre.
I wonder if, I mean, also, he sort of paints a picture where, he sort of describes UKRI as bureaucratic, and he wants, ARIA to exist outside of its structures. He also talked about bog standard vice chancellors, which is eye-catching. I mean, my first question is, who is he talking about there? Who are the bog standard vice chancellors? And is there a sort of broader narrative? He's out of government, but look, read the Defence Review, and you made the point on a site, didn't you, DK, that, higher education is basically not mentioned at all. But there's a sort of view, which Dominic Cummings is laying out there, where universities aren't really part of the kind of the exciting or important or impactful end of the research landscape, or the stuff that kind of gets conservative voters excited, all the big hardware and all the rest. I mean, is that, is that by design, or is that, so has that kind of fallen out of, the kind of vagaries and weirdnesses of what Dominic Cummings is interested in?
So to go for the, there's a lot in that question, Mark. So to go for the bog standard vice chancellor thing, he was talking about the kind of people that should be in charge of ARIA, that should be the chairperson, the chief exec, that are setting the direction that ARIA should go in. And he sees that as a scientist. He kind of reeled off a list of white male established scientists in exactly the way you might expect. And he said at the end of this that it would be a disaster to have a bog standard vice chancellor running this thing. He didn't really give any reason for that, but that was what he said. He also said, because obviously this all, you could kind of see this building towards an almost biblical reveal, and it was Greg Clark, I think, who has absolutely no love whatsoever for Dominic Cummings. Yeah,
yeah. I must say that it's kind of quite.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Insulting, I would say, to very many vice chancellors who are working really hard to run this massive, complex institution driving research. But on the other hand, I do understand what he's trying to say a little bit. Maybe I'm trying to find a reason madness.
Put yourself on the shoes.
So, for example, I think what he's looking for people who will really push the boundary, really challenge. I think in one of the articles I read that he said, if most of the research ARIA will do will fail, and if they're not failing, then ARIA is failing. So that's a strong statement. So, and from a research perspective, it kind of makes sense because you really would like to take substantial risks to do some research that really solves problems that exist in the globe. Now, what sort of problem you're trying to solve? Is it primarily security, defense, that sort of angle, or whether this is the problem related to the 17 goals that we have in sustainability from the United Nations? That's, of course, something we need to look at. But I think we do need people who are, how can I say, those nutty professors. I think that's what he's looking for. And to be honest, not mentioning university is bizarre because we are full of it.
Yes. certainly. I mean, it's an archetype. It's an idea of this is a creative person, somebody obsessed with science. But you've got to bear in mind that the person who leads ARIA is, they need to be an expert in, say, molecular genetics. They need to be an expert in zero carbon technology. They need to be an expert in any other weird thing that ARIA decides to do. And that, to me, feels like more of a vice-chancellor skill set or a really good program manager skill set, somebody who can take an overview of a number of different areas and be excited about the exciting things, but without necessarily being in depth. If you appoint a scientist is an expert in their particular area of science. That is what drives them. That is their passion. And I'm always concerned when people are promoted into roles when they can't do the thing that they're really passionate about. That seems to me to be the opposite of what ARIA needs to be about.
Absolutely. You're totally right, because we have seen across the sector, so sometimes we end up recruiting the best teacher to be leading on the teaching side or the best researcher to lead on the research side. And we actually, that's not the right thing to do, because they are not experts in budget, in project management. If there's £11 billion to invest in research, you need a project manager who really can find the talent and manage the budget. That's not exciting for a mad scientist.
I mean, that is the quirks of our, you know, fantastic world leading university system. I mean, Amory, you know about recruiting students more than most people. How important as a signal is it that the government sends about the research infrastructure, particularly when it comes to Ruskin universities or anywhere else really on the landscape? You know, how, where is this in the hierarchy of how students think about where to apply?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, the first thing to say is I try to avoid the deep psychology of Dom Cummings. For those of us who've worked across various parts of the education landscape, I think we learned a few years ago that it doesn't get you very far. And this archetype of the lone genius is completely true to type with Dom Cummings. I think actually for those students who are considering sort of progressing to postgraduate research, I actually think this could be quite an off-putting idea, this idea of the maverick genius, that the lone breakthrough. Whereas we know most of the really superb research, you know, if you just look at the vaccine, the AstraZeneca vaccine, we know that that comes through collaboration. And so, you know, the super signal here that, you know, we're after people who have breakthroughs singularly on their own is potentially not helpful for encouraging folks into research.
And I mean, am I right in saying, DK, I seem to remember you wrote about how ARIA is not going to have any postdocs, or it's, you know, it's not going to plug into that part of a landscape. Am I right to say that?
It's very early days yet to say what ARIA is actually going to do, but it doesn't look like it is the kind of thing. I mean, there are no links across between ARIA and UCRI. There are certainly no links to the Office for Students. They don't seem to be thinking about the idea of studentship, which is really daft if you think about it. I mean, one of the things Dominic Cummings said in the hearings is the problem that the current system of science funding presents to early career researchers who have got amazing ideas. And he's absolutely right in that. And there is sensible stuff we could do around that to support early career researchers, to give them the slightly open-ended funding that lets them establish the area that they want to devote their lives to. And he was quite clear that ARIA is not that. ARIA is something that it's the best of the best. It's the Top Gun School of Research, if you will.
Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
My name is Mara Deepwell, and I'm the Chief Executive of the Association for Learning Technology. We're really excited to share with all the Wonky readers key findings from ALF annual survey about learning technology in 2020. The survey is really exciting this year, particularly because we've expanded it to include a special section painting the landscape of learning technology in COVID times. One of the key findings that we're looking at is how the pivot online has impacted on the well-being of staff and students, how budgets have been affected, where have there been cuts within institutions, and who has invested in what. We're also looking particularly at the emerging and growing trend of leadership in learning technology, which now 20% of our members have as a key focus of their role. We've released three key reports with all the summary of findings. So openly accessible via the ELSE website.
Okay, OFS is back talking about admissions this week, and Heppy has a new pamphlet all about the topic. Anne-Marie, what jumped out at you?
Yeah, it's a bonus week for admissions in universities. First of all, we've got the OFS chief executive, Nicola Dandridge, publishing a blog cautioning universities against over-recruitment. And this was picked up pretty strongly by various mainstream media outlets, particularly focused in on the word swamped, which I think is a very unfortunate word indeed. Nicola said in a blog that she'd be willing to have the regulator intervene where she saw this sort of over-recruitment that sacrifices quality. And then the second big bit of admissions news is Heppy have landed today a fabulous, fabulous set of essays about post-qualification admissions. I have to say, it's one of the things I've enjoyed reading most over the past year. 12 essays, all killer, no filler. Great set of perspectives, all of them bringing something interesting. Particular highlights for me, there's a lovely overview of sort of the grades and exams issued by NFER colleagues. You've got David Hawkins from UniGuys sort of comparing against international admission systems, and a really thoughtful and considered essay from the Queen of Admissions, Mary Kernott Cook, where she calls for people outside of this sort of nerdy world of HE admissions to be brought to the table to bring a fresh perspective. So I really enjoyed reading this. There's a lot in there. Really recommends colleagues across the sector.
So start with the OFS. It's kind of felt like a bit of a shot across the bows, isn't it? Or kind of canary in the coal mine. Because, I mean, you'd absolutely expect there to be a rise in unconditional offers this year. So are they kind of trying to get ahead of the fight, do you think?
I have to say, I'm slightly baffled by this intervention. The crux of the issue is that they're seeing universities where offers are being made purely on the predicted grades rather than the sort of generated grades that we'll eventually see later this year. We're at this moment in time where schools and colleges are waiting for the DfE to clarify what will happen with award allocations this year. So actually, we're in a bit of a no man's land right now. I think this response by universities, certainly it's not unexpected as a response. I think the real issue is that we're seeing sort of a moving of those application populations across the system. And I think that's actually the issue at hand here and why Nicola's chosen to publish the blog.
And I'm actually glad you mentioned predicted grades. One of the highlights of that Heppy pamphlet for me was the Mark Corver essay, I thought. And I mean, DK, this is one of your pet issues. I mean, Mark Corver argues that, as he has in the past, the data doesn't support axing predicted grades.
Well, he's absolutely right. Yeah. I've made exactly the same point on the site, on Wonky, several times. If you do go through UCAS's own data and you do that kind of number crunching, there is no clear benefit from axing predicted grades from the system. It's another data point. It's a data point that comes direct from the teachers and the schools, which is something that is important in understanding a candidate. And it is something that makes for a system that functions broadly. It does a pretty good job. It's far from perfect, but I don't see any way in which the removal of predicted grades is going to make it any better. This round of discussion about PQA, as you know, it seems to come round every 2 or 3 years. It's actually coming round earlier every year, I think. This round seems to have stemmed from the research of Jill Wyness. It's a classic example of the same data being able to tell people different things. She sees an underprediction of grades for students from disadvantaged backgrounds. There's a little bit of evidence of that, but it is dwarfed by the sad fact that students from disadvantaged backgrounds tend to do less well at A-levels and other equivalent qualifications. That is the massive problem with the system. And the absolute last thing you would want to do to fix that is to make a system that is even more reliant on those final exams.
I mean, one of the things reading both the Heppy admissions paper, but then also going and looking at the DfE's consultation on this, which is open until May, if folks would like to respond, is if we look at what is the problem we want to solve, The problem is predicted grades. The problem is not the admission system. And so I'm reading the essay. I'm just, you know, everything comes back to those predicted grades. So for me, post-qualification admission sort of misses the point of the nub of the issue, the thing we really want to change to help young people get, you know, a great start in terms of going to university or other destinations if they want to head off to the world of work or training.
I mean, you also mentioned Mary Cullough-Cook, another friend of the show. Azama, she had some interesting observations about the, you know, this debate in itself is kind of the same people having it every 10 years and is kind of absolutely desperate for some new ideas. And one of them that she floated was, you know, or the question she asked really, should universities be applying for students rather than the other way around? What do you make of that?
That's a very interesting proposal. I think as an economist, I would say that that's probably going to be an odd situation because, you know, if there are more demand and less supply, I don't know how that come to an equilibrium if we have to apply for students. However, I do completely agree with DK that and Mary as well, that predictive grades play a major role. If you think of an individual, once they receive a predicted grade, they start to work towards it. And that's an important thing. And I think to some extent, that's why I'm slightly sympathetic towards Nicola's movement towards cautioning us. Because the moment we give them an unconditional offer, you are pretty much telling a learner that no matter how much you would like to learn until July, it really doesn't matter. You have secured your space. So I think to some extent, predicted grade and then ultimately making a decision once the actual grade is out is not a bad thing. So I'm also struggling to understand what we are trying to solve here. On the other hand, I do take the point that the sad truth of ethnic minorities or lower socioeconomic part of the society who are unfortunately, year on year for decades are not performing as well in A-level, and that's causing an access issue. So the contextual admission is something that is very close to my heart, and I think we should really be looking into it. But removing predicted grade, in fact, as a matter of fact, if somebody understands planning in university, how would we plan student number if we don't have any predictive grades? Because that gives us an indication what would be the year like next year.
I think we just need to go back briefly to the Nicola Dandridge intervention in her suggestion that instead of using the arbitrary grades put together by teachers later this summer, some universities have been making offers based on the arbitrary grades that teachers put together at the end of last year. It's just that if you look at what's actually happening with A-levels this year and the vagaries and the stresses that are being placed on applicants, in some respects, unconditional offers are the answer to that. And you would think a regulator that has the interest of students at heart might potentially be saying, look, if we've done our due diligence, if we think this is the right student for this course and the students think it's the right course for them, why not just confirm those places now and dispense with all this panic towards the end of the summer?
Yeah, I mean, it gives students security in a year where they've had very little security in terms of their education and outcomes. So for me, that's one of the issues around this sort of post-qualification admissions reform. It's coming at a time where, you know, we've talked about students and we've talked about universities. What about our teachers, schools and colleges? Because I was speaking to a teacher a couple of days ago and I said, what do you think about this? He said, as if I've got time to think about this right now. He said, you know, it's like asking a firefighter to talk about polishing their boots. Like there are bigger things that I'm dealing with in terms of getting kids' education back on track. So for me, you know, this is actually the most high quality debate I think I've seen on PQA in terms of it's quite lively, lots of people are involved, but the timing is really not good for colleagues across the rest of the education system. And the last thing to say is I think there are a lot of other ideas, smaller ideas that we should be looking at before we think about a whole over sort of turning of the current system. I'd love to see changes like a cooling off period between grades and clearing. I'd like to see schools getting grades at the same time as universities. And do you know what? If you were really worried about undermatching, you were really worried about underprediction, there's a really simple tweak to the system. And that is you hold back places for students who've been underpredicted through adjustment. You know, that's available to us and we can make that happen from this cycle if we wanted to.
The policing bill has garnered a great deal of coverage this week. And Jim on the site has been highlighting how this might impact on student protests. DK, walk us through it.
So there is a saying amongst Home Office civil servants at the moment, and they say, wouldn't it be nice at least once not to look like we're setting up an authoritarian state? So, I mean, once again, here we are. It felt looked cloth-eared when it was published after the shocking and absolutely shameful events at the vigil for Sarah Everard. It just looks like it's just in bad taste at this stage. So on the site, and I strongly recommend you read the article, it's got a lot more detail in. Jim is particularly concerned about the implication of the restrictions that this that the text on the face of this bill would put on protest, in particular student protests. You might think this is a strange thing for the government to want to do, given that they're absolutely dedicated to free speech on campus. I couldn't possibly comment on that. So this, even though there's lots of legislation that covers this area already, this amounts to a strengthening of stuff against protest. They start sensibly, they talk about stuff like intimidation is unacceptable and that willfully causing damage is unacceptable, which we could largely agree with. But then they start talking about serious unease, alarm, or distress. But that feels like they're actually talking about noise. They're talking about noise. They're talking about unpleasant arguments. They're talking about the kind of things that upsets kind of ministers and politicians if they turn up a place and there are 60 people with placards singing songs at them. Now, the Students' Union has got an incredible tradition of protest. I think probably all of us have been on various protests over the years. And although they don't necessarily achieve the thing they're protesting for, they are effective because they make it clear that people are upset with the course of action, that people are concerned about a particular group, that people have serious disagreements about public policy. And a lot of this bill looks like trying to shut down that kind of protest, which needs to be a part of public life.
Azama, you partly run a massive university. Did you welcome a kind of legal crackdown on occupations and protests on campus, or do you think that's going to have a chilling effect?
That's going to have a chilling effect, no doubt about it. I can't welcome a policy like that at all, to be honest. Totally believe in freedom of speech and expression, and that's the heart of university ethos anyway. In fact, our president of the current student union, Lizzie, wrote a couple of blogs with other authors on Wonky as well about free speech and what it means for the students and how some of the policies that we have already, like Prevent, might be having a little bit of impact on it. And this is probably another thing that's it is a chilling situation, to be honest. And as a matter of fact, I was reflecting on Black Lives Matter. There was a lot of movements and protests and things like that. And I'm getting worried that would we be able to have those debates and the protest and the emotion that comes out of Black Lives Matter if this policing bill is being enforced? So a lot of worry from my side, to be honest.
I mean, I'd personally love to hear about all of our favourite protests. I think that would be a great discussion to have. But I agree with the sentiments already. You know, this is sort of very worrying movement. For me, it's the line around sort of serious annoyance. And, you know, I tell you what's annoying, you know, banging a drum outside of an office. That is a classic bit of, you know, it's a classic bit of protest tactic. I have the joy of working in Millbank Tower when I'm not working from home. And you know, it's a daily occurrence. This, I think, has sort of been born from the Extinction Rebellion actions of the past couple of years. Certainly when I worked at King's trying to get across Waterloo Bridge when they were occupying the bridge was a real experience. So it is deeply concerning. You know, we can be creative as we want with protest tactics. And we always say the action is in the reaction for those of us who used to be involved with student politics. But really, the capacity to make noise on campus will be curtailed by this.
And as DK says, I recommend reading Jim's article, which picks apart the bill, on the site. Links in the show notes.
Oh, one last thing to say on this one.
Go on.
I don't know if folks saw, but there was a piece of polling earlier in the week around sort of in the wake of the Sarah Everard vigil showing that the general public, you know, thought the police had acted appropriately and supported that. Actually, there's been some further polling today and released by Politico, which shows actually the view of the general public is much more balanced, and the majority of people from all sorts of backgrounds think that it was sort of heavy-handed and not needed. So it's an evolving picture as to how the general public feel about protest and particularly in relation to this bill.
Yeah, and I guess the other point is that there's a bit of a journey still left for this bill, isn't it? I mean, it's got to go through the Lords, and you'd expect there to be, you know, a lot of lobbying from all different sides to water down some of these proposals. I wonder if the sector should be doing some of that. I mean, it's not a bread and butter sector for the issue, but, you know, I think, you know, there are a lot of friends of HE in the Lords, and there are a lot of people who wouldn't want to turn campuses into, I guess, this dystopian view of kind of everyone sitting quietly eating a sandwich on a bench and, you know, no noise. I mean, jeez. I mean, yeah, I enjoyed making noise on campus as much as the next person.
Absolutely. If that ever happens, I'm going to leave the campus straight away. That'll be a boring campus altogether if the students are not raising their voices.
It'll be like what it looks like in the prospectuses. Everyone just sort of sitting on rugs on the lawn, just sort of smiling and playing with their phones and, yeah.
Hey, there are quiet forms and introverted forms of protest. A classic is the die-in, for example. Mm. It's interesting, right, the point about the Lords, because the Lords has a lot of folks who have been elevated to that position because of their incredible campaigning and sort of social change record. So, yeah, let's see what happens as this thing progresses.
And now it's time for Mike Ratcliffe and the hidden history of HE.
Expanding our universities is one of those things that has been an issue all the way through the history. How do we deal with that? How do we deal with the fact that there comes a point where government needs to expand our universities and think about how it wants to organise that? Now, less so in a market type system, but when we had planning bodies, how should we do that? Now, the biggest set of expansion came straight after the Second World War, where they knew in advance that returning students were going to come back, either they already gone off to war, they'd been off into the variety of different occupations, and they were going to want to have higher education. The Americans handled this through their GI Bill, but we set about just expanding our universities. And the interesting bit is that we started planning for this in active way in 1943. So before we've even invaded Normandy, the British university sector is planning to have won the war and how it's going to cope with all the students who are going to come back. So excellent planning from the UGC. And off it goes. It works out that actually it doesn't really need to expand the number of universities, because most of the universities it's been funding have been really small all the way through the 30s. Again, if we think we have trouble now, try running a university through the Great Depression when most of the students have to pay their fees. So they've not expanded as much as they thought, so they were ready for them all to expand. The only difference is that the chair of the UGC, Walter Mobley, is persuaded to let the University College of North Staffordshire start. And so A.D. Lindsay persuades him that it would be a really good idea to set up a new kind of university. And Mobley is very concerned about how the war has gone, how it's impacted on universities, and he thinks we need new types of students. And so they're allowed to run a four-year course, predominantly residential, an opportunity to have a foundation course at the minute. So it's trying to do something different. And they get going, and everyone else starts to expand. And then we go through the 50s, just slowly upgrading universities. So the university colleges become universities. They all expand. There's a bit of a backlash if you think about Kingsley Amis and Lucky Jim and his more means worse thing. But generally, this is the idea that we can continue. By the end of the decade, it's clear we need more universities. They accede to a bid from Sussex to set up a new university college at Brighton. But then, having got to that stage, they have a pause and think it's probably worth having a think about setting up new types of universities. And then starts this marvellous thing, this bidding competition to have universities. So the bidding competition to have new universities is an excellent and really exciting example of how British university planning worked. They set up a subcommittee. Great and the good come on the subcommittee. They happily sit together, work out what they should do. Now, people have been writing in saying, hello, can I have a university, for a while now. So they've got a file already of towns and cities that said, can we have a university, please? So they're ready to go. So they've got a group of people they can contact and say, are you still interested in having a university? And they work out what the criteria are for having a good university. It needs plenty of land in order to expand. It needs to have good access to schools so that staff will come and let their kids go to those schools. It needs to have a certain amount of industry nearby and communications to other universities, but there's no kind of fixed idea of what they should do. They also don't have a fixed idea of where they should be, so they just let the applications come in and then sort them out. So different local authorities spring up with ideas and write in, sending in their different bits, some from rather unlikely places. So for quite a long time, the one making the running in the northwest was Blackpool. We're going to have the University of Blackpool. That attracted quite a lot of comment because Blackpool was a slightly challenging place, and so people had different views on this. And the best bit of that is someone who cheerfully wrote in to the UGC saying, he says, I beg to strongly oppose the current suggestion that a university for the northwest of England should be established at or on the outskirts of Blackpool. A university is supposed to be a place where young people absorb culture and learning, not spivvery and paganism. And he goes on to say that he can't imagine a worse place to put a university apart from Soho. Now, it turns out that Lancashire starts to move more in the direction of Lancaster itself. They acquire some land at Berwick, and Lancaster gets a nod over Blackpool. But we go through these independent writing-in exercises. So there's a businessman who's driving past Stamford in Lincolnshire, and he hears that the people at Stamford might be quite interested in having a university. They're one of the places that had a university suppressed in the Middle Ages, and he gets really involved in this, and he effectively becomes the leading light of this constant bid to have a university for Stamford. And they get quite a long way down the thinking. One of the key reasons is that Stamford's got a new bypass, so it's got plenty of land, it's been redeveloped, and it can think about having a university. And there's a whole published report on why it would be a good thing for the University of Stamford to get going, and these keep going through. So there's a bid for University at Glastonbury. This nice chap writes in and says it'd be great to build a new university city of Avalon next to Glastonbury, and create a new university city. Now, he doesn't get anyone else supporting him, but there on the UGC file is his nice letter and the very polite letter back from the civil servants of the UGC saying, well, that's very interesting. Do follow up with some more details. So you go through these kind of stages, and there is a long list of places that at some point are considered to have a new university, some of whom, that's fine, they go and get their university. So we have bids from Bournemouth and Carlisle and Chatham and Chester, and there's one from Coventry, which is obviously quite successful, but Plymouth and Salisbury and Stamford and Stevenage and Thanet is one of the ones that makes one of the early running again, but in the end is passed over in terms of Canterbury. So you get this kind of wonderful pickup of these things, and the files are just great as you go through them, and you get this different information sent in by these people trying to say, well, can we have a university, please? So the best correspondence I found on the file is from the Swindon people. So the Swindon people start by this very apologetic letter from the town clerk saying, people in Swindon have asked me to write. I'm not sure personally about doing this, but what's the process? And then he kind of gets more into it, and the Swindon say, well, one of the things we want to do is deal with the fact that there's a perception that we're quite a dreary town and a university might be quite good for us. So they kind of talk about how this might go through. And his correspondence backwards and forwards goes on and on over about 4 years because they don't quite get going in time. And slowly, it's clear that other people are getting their universities, but they're not. So by the end, when it's quite clear that there aren't going to be any more universities, this is sad little letter in from the town clerk to the UGC. Please do not groan too deeply when you receive this letter. I'm not going to harass you. I know that nothing can be done until the government announcement has been made about new universities. And he goes on to say, well, perhaps we could use a new bit of land. It might be a better bet for our new Swindon University. And he ends it in a sad little sign-off. Now, please don't toss this into the waste paper basket. Now, the good news is that it was all dutifully considered by the UGC. It's still lovingly kept on the file. Swindon did not get to have its university. The cut-off had come, and the government had changed its mind on how many universities it wanted. Because at that point, the new Labour government decides, that's it, no more universities, we're going to stop approving them. We've got enough students into the planning period, and we'll have no more.
And finally, the Social Market Foundation has a fresh report out all about HENFE. Anne-Marie, talk us through what that said.
Fabulous. This is a report, as you say, by the Social Market Foundation, looking at sort of the collaboration and competition between higher education and further education, with the title Study Buddies. It's actually a fascinating report, and I'd highly recommend colleagues have a read. It interviews sort of 20 further education and higher education principals. And I mean, some of the quotes are just incredible in there. But it paints a picture of sort of areas of unproductive and excessive competition and lots lots of barriers to properly collaborating across those two sectors, but actually underpinning it a great degree of goodwill towards sort of trying to build that through more clearly. It's obvious that there are regulatory barriers to that. There are other forms of barriers to creating a more collaborative and functional ecosystem between HE and FE. One of the interviewees describes the relationship currently in some areas of the country as fratricidal, which I think is very interesting indeed. Lots of recommendations, packed to the rafters with recommendations in terms of how these two sectors should collaborate, but also what policymakers should do to make that more possible.
You're an economist, as you said. I mean, when you create scarcity of supply, then you're going to create competition, aren't you? I mean, is it the system built for competition rather than for creating proper portfolio provision and looking at where different parts of the education system can work together?
Yes, I do agree with that when there is scarcity, there will be competition. But I think we can coexist in a nice way. So I really welcome this report where there is a lot of good recommendation. We need to understand that there are technical education, there are education where the training part is really needed to be solid, where somebody coming from banking, from industry, from chemical engineering, and training the apprentices in a fruitful way. And I don't think necessarily higher education create that sort of academic in plenty, whereas I would say that further education definitely have a strong foothold. So I think we need to start to agree that we can carve the market differently and look into how different sorts of academic existing in HE and FE can provide different sort of skill set and education to the community. I think, you know, it's important for us to set aside some of those competition. I would say that more in the new type of university and creative universities, the competition is steeper because, you know, you can well imagine that a very well-established FE lately becoming a higher education institution and suddenly creating competition with existing higher education in the sector. But generally, you can make an ecosystem where both of us can work fruitfully for the whole country.
Mm. I mean, Anne-Marie, you're involved in the Bradford Opportunity Area, aren't you? I mean, what's your experience of how this works in practice? Do you recognise that fratricidal kind of impulse?
well, I think one of the things we're really developing in Bradford is sort of a plan across the city about how we all come together to ensure better education and skills for young people. And we know that when people are at loggerheads or you know, there's a dysfunctional relationship, that doesn't serve young people well. So actually in Bradford, I think there's a very collaborative relationship between, you know, HE, FE and various other providers of training and skills in the city. I think for me, this report and also my experience in Bradford, the thing I'd really sort of highlight is that power differential between HE and FE. And one of the reasons there's such a dramatic power differential is, you know, FE occupies this space that the report calls the messy middle, where they, you know, they have a reduced negotiating power. They have lots of interventions in terms of policy and regulation. And so that hinders their capacity to really sort of, you know, negotiate and interact with HE or deliver HE and FE in more powerful ways. So it's interesting. The picture changes where you look in the country, I think. Certainly in Bradford, we've got an increasingly joined up approach between the different sectors.
And I noticed David Hughes this morning of AOC was supportive of a lot of the recommendations and the report in general. I mean, he's often an advocate for both sectors working more closely together. We've talked about this on the show before, but it would be lovely to see people from the HE side of the equation stand up and say similar things.
Yeah, completely. It feels rather one-sided. And actually, if you read the report, I mean, obviously there's a selection of quotes, but you certainly can feel that there are some of those participants who are perhaps more sceptical about the idea of working together or don't see the value as much as others. But on the whole, you can see both the vice chancellors and the principals of the FE colleges really pushing towards the same aim. I think the big trick here is that response to the sort of local skills requirements and what the labour market is really calling for. That for me is the key link up where HE and FE working together. I mean, that's the golden land, right? That's the promised land. So it certainly would be refreshing to hear more colleagues in the HE sector speaking up for this agenda.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to delve deeper into anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes. Or head to wonky.com to find out more about our range of brilliant subscription services, keeping you and your organisation one step ahead of UK higher education policy every single day. Don't forget, you can subscribe to this podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Spotify, Apple or Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. Or find the feed you need on wonky.com/podcast. So thanks to Azama, Anne-Marie and DK for joining me today. And for production support by Jim Dickinson, Matt Grogan and the rest of Team Wonky, The Wonky Show is executive produced by me, Mark Leach. Until next week, stay safe, stay wonky.